Accession number 12149, real 4.
Sergeant Sutton, real 4.
The signal which you sent out on sighting enemy battleships was 000, and that was a priority which closed down all the rest of the radio at that time. Everybody waited to hear the report of enemy battleships, which that priority meant. And so I sent my reports, and then I moved round the Italian fleet, gradually finding more and more and more bits of it and sending back signals back to the Illustrious, and of course they were being intercepted in the flagship, the Warspite. Now we had two battleships, one aircraft carrier, four cruisers, and nine destroyers at sea. And as soon as the Italians realized that they were being shadowed, because of course we were pretty plain blue sky at that stage, you could see their wakes go down, and the sterns go down, and the white wake pile up as they increase speed. And they went off back towards Italy. I thought I was going to bring about a great naval battle, that there would be air attacks which would hamper the Italian fleet and delay them, and then the Admiral Cunningham would move in with his battleships and sink the rest and things, and there was going to be glory for all time for Sutton. But I shadowed for a very long time until eventually I decided I had to come back. I was going to fall in the sea otherwise. And I arrived back after about 4.5 or 3/4 hours in the air with an aircraft whose endurance was 4.5 hours only, more or less hanging on a propeller like a helicopter. And we got rid of everything to reduce the weight. Lee was my pilot at that time, and one of the earliest things I'd done had been to jettison the anti-submarine depth charges which I had on board. And Lee said, "Oh no, please, may I drop them on the enemy?" And I said, "Well," he said, "Oh come on, Alfie, let me have them." So I said, "Right over, just this once, let me get out of it." So he dropped these near the enemy battleship from about 10,000 feet. they didn't know anything, of course, but they caused consternation. And then I, at that stage, had jettisoned my ciphering equipment. We had a nasty metal box, which is a terrible thing which one had to work to encode one's messages. Well, I reckoned, as I was following the Italian fleet, and they knew where they were and what they were, what the hell do I have to encode my messages about them? So I threw this over the side to lighten the aircraft. And I'd lightened the aircraft in every possible way one could think of doing it, and eventually we got back with just enough petrol to get back on the deck, not even to make a circuit. I received a message from my captain, subsequently, from the commander-in-chief, which was very gratifying, saying that never for a moment had he been in doubt as to the composition and disposition of the enemy. My reports were excellent. And indeed, they were put into a sort of standard book on scouting and reconnaissance. Well, that was that. But what I hadn't realized, of course, at that stage was that we were going to attack on Trafalgar Day. There was the original concept of attacking Taranto, and Cunningham didn't want to attack and waste his effort on attacking the ships at sea. He wanted to catch them in harbour and get them there. That was his plan. I didn't know that as a young lieutenant. Anyhow, I was very disappointed that I hadn't thought about a naval battle. And that was my next book mention, Patches, that, eh? Next thing that happened on board the Illustrious was a series of disasters. Just before the October intended attack on Taranto, there was a fire in the hangar, fitting the overload tanks, petrol tanks, which were going to fly to Taranto, these for the torpedo aircraft were a big tank which was put in the observer's cockpit in the aircraft, and the observer was then displaced and sat right down in the tail, in the air gunner's position, and much less in the air gunner's position, squeezed in. So you had the pilot, enormous great petrol tank in the aircraft, and the observer. The petrol tank was not self-sealing. In those days, they weren't. And fitting one of these, an air fitter was using magnetic tools, ferrous tools, and caused a spark. There was the remains of petrol vapor in the tank, and it blew out the whole of the stern of that aircraft and caused a fire in the hangar. We all examined the aircraft and realized what was going to happen to us if our tanks blew up when we were on, using this means of getting this extra range. The fire in the hangar caused a lot of trouble. It got water into the petrol system, and for a time afterwards we had aircraft force landing because they had got salt water into the petrol system. It also, the fire damaged a number of aircraft. Now, at that stage, the Eagle was getting so old and so tired that she couldn't keep up with the fleet anymore. So the next thing was that the attack was postponed until the 11th of November. And for that attack, to replace the burned aircraft and the ones that had force landed in the sea and that whole thing, a portion of the Eagle squadrons moved over to the Illustrious and reinforced us for the actual attack on Taranto. The actual, it's a silly thing, of course, that we do things on anniversaries. The Italians were expecting an attack on Trafalgar Night. The British are silly this way. And then to choose Armistice Night and so on, again, wasn't terribly clever, but then, of course, it's an anniversary of the day of the year. Anyhow, 11th of November. We got very good intelligence on Taranto from the Air Force. The Air Force in Malta had some fairly fast reconnaissance aircraft provided by the United States, which we called Marylands. I don't know what the Americans called them. Maybe the same. They took a series of photographs of Taranto Harbor. Our original plan of attack was the conventional one for a night attack. I described to you how we took, we used to do a dawn attack, get down very low with the enemy silhouetted and the little thing and the rising light. The same thing occurs at night, but you illuminate the enemy against the moon or with flares or something and get down low, come in from a dark sector and attack him, torpedo him. These series of RAF reconnaissance photographs that were taken showed that the Italians had surrounded the Taranto harbour with balloon barrage. Now, we had not anticipated this at all. They were used, of course, we knew at home, in the mouth of the Thames and around London and so on. But this caused great consternation. The two squadron commanders, Williamson for the first raid and Hale for the second, were given the choice of how they were going to attack the harbour with our squadrons. Williamson decided that he must get in low with the enemy silhouetted and risk running at the balloon barrage, that this was a justifiable risk. That was the first attack. Hale, my squadron commander, decided that the thing to do was that we had to get in and get at the enemy, and on no account must we be brought down before we got there. And therefore, we would go in over the top of the balloon barrage and dive down inside it and straighten out on the water. Now, this was a method of daylight attack, which was used in attacking fleets and so on, but wasn't used and had never been used at night. But so you can imagine, there was this enclosed harbour with the breakwaters around it and the forts, and right in the inner side of it there were the battleships. And the final photograph that we received showed six battleships. The last battleship of the Italian Navy had joined the five that I had seen at sea and was there. And the whole of the Italian battle fleet, as we now know, was concentrated because the Italians were going to attack the Greek island of Corfu and take that. This was the supporting force. Then outside the battleships, they were tucked right up into a knuckle of the breakwaters, there were a group of cruisers surrounded by nets. And then round the whole of that lot, there were the balloons, some attached to the breakwater, some to the land, and some to floats in the water to complete a complete circuit, ellipse. The attack was taking place in two waves. Williamson with 815 Squadron went off in the first wave, and frankly it was a bit of a shambles, but they did an attack and they got a number of hits. Williamson himself and his observer Scarlett, they were brought down or came down. One suspects that they hit the water because the swordfish had not got any accurate altitude instruments for low flying. And if you were doing low flying over the water at night, then it was a very risky business. Your altimeter started to work at about 150 feet. Otherwise you were doing it by eye. And Williamson, one suspects, hit the water and going in. I don't know. He's dead now. We had the second raid. Now, the idea was that each raid would be six torpedo aircraft, four bombers, and two flare droppers. Flare droppers to drop line of flares in case the moon wasn't bright enough to attack by moonlight, and the bombers to cause diversion from the torpedo aircraft so that the enemy would think that the actual fact that there was a bombing raid, not a torpedo raid. Well, now, we took off, I can't remember, about 50 minutes after the first wave, and of course they had attacked, and we had no surprise at all. We made for the tip of Italy, the lighthouse right on the heel of Italy, Santa Maria di Lucia, and then saw off the shore. But all the way up the coast, we could see the searchlights probing and the gunfire. We were well out of that, of course. We were miles up beyond that, but it didn't deter the Italians from firing. But we had no surprise. We were followed all the way up the coast. And then when we got up towards Taranto, now Taranto is a great sweep of a bay in the northern end of that gulf. It runs, first of all, towards the east to west, and then curves round and comes round towards the south. Now, our idea was that we would have reached about 10,000 feet with torpedoes on the approach, and we would cross the coast up to the northwest of Taranto and then weave across the coast backwards and forwards, because the Italians hadn't got radar, but they had very efficient sound locating equipment. And if you move backwards and forwards over the coast, then the sound of the breaking waves holds the sound locators and pulls them off the aircraft, and they then got to sweep back and find you again and so on. So we wove in over the coast, over the breaking waves, the coastline, and then what we then had to do was to dive down into the attacking positions. Now, we had worked out that there was a quadrilateral of water about a half a mile by about a bit less than a half a mile wide either way in the middle of the defences between the cruisers and the battleships, in which if we could get down to that position, then from the reconnaissance photographs the RAF had given us, there was a complete arc of about 50 degrees where we must hit a battleship. They were all overlapping each other. So if we dropped a torpedo from that position, however we ran, they ran, or wherever we dropped in that position, we were going to hit something. Now, that's fine, except that the position we'd chosen was just outside the entrance to the inner harbour, which was extremely heavily defended with close-range weapons. The Italians had the outer harbour where the cruisers and the battleships were lying, and then they had the inner harbour where there was a mass of destroyers and more cruisers. And in the gut between the two, it was off this position where was our dropping position. Now, we went in over the coast, as I said, and then leader went over the top and down into that sort of screaming torpedo dive. Of course, the only dive bomber we had in the British forces was a swordfish. It could dive very steeply. And straight away, we were in a box barrage. You know what a box barrage is? There's an imaginary box in the air, and all the guns fire in that box, and the box is controlled by the ground gunnery control and moved ahead of the bombers, wherever else it is. So we were in a mass of twinkling, bursting shells, and went down through that. The aircraft ahead of us was hit, and I saw an orange flash and a sort of puff, and that was that. They were killed. That was the last aircraft in the flight ahead of us. I was flying with Torrance Spence, and we came down a little bit too soon over the cruisers. He pulled up over the masts of the cruisers and then down onto the water on the other side towards the battleships. And he said, first of all, one to port's too close, what's it ahead? Now, to port there was a Duilio, that's one of the old First World War modernized battleships they had. And ahead there was a Littorio. And I told him it was a Littorio ahead. He said, right, we'll take that. And there was I, with my standing up as taut as I could in the stern of the aircraft, on the end of my monkey chain, which holds you safety, with my chin resting on this bloody overload tank of petrol, which I knew if it went off it was going to blow me to hell, trying to direct my pilot into what was going on. The first thing, we went in towards the Littorio, and the first thing that happened was the torpedo failed to come off. Tom Spence said, torpedo's failed, I'm recocking, and then he recocked, and then went in again. Not in the game, it went straight on. And by that time, the Littorio had seen us, and the whole of the horizon was ship, enemy ship. And all down it, one could see the stabbing points of flame as they concentrated on us going in. And, of course, we were at a centre of an incredible crossfire. The torpedo released the second time. Now, when you're dropping a torpedo in those days, it was, in actual fact, a ship torpedo, actually a submarine torpedo, modified for air use. And you had to put it in slightly nose first, or the torpedo broke, the stern broke off. If you put it in tail first, the stern broke off. There were reels of wire, to piano wire, on reels, from the stern of the torpedo up to the aircraft, and these had to unwind, and this made certain that the torpedo went in nose first, there was a slight drag on the aircraft, one had to make quite certain that the torpedo was dropped in level, because a torpedo is controlled by horizontal and vertical fins, and if you put it in crooked, the horizontal fins, which are worked, the vertical fins, which are worked by a gyroscope, act as horizontal and take the torpedo down to depth, and the horizontal fins, which are meant to take it down to depth, then take it, slicing it off to one direction. So it has to be placed in very carefully. So you have to concentrate on putting the torpedo into the water at the right height, at the right speed, not break it, and then once it's clear and released to the aircraft and the piano wire is all finished, I know it sounds very heavy tape, but that's the way it was, you then get away. So we dropped the torpedo, held on course for I don't know how many seconds it is, and then away to starboard, and by that time, of course, the enemy ship was almost right up against us, or seemed to be, and down onto the water, and smack, bloody great shudder through the aircraft, and I thought, we're down, but weren't. Now, what would happen was, we'd hit the water with the wheels of the fixed undercarriage. Now, my pilot, Thomas Spence, is a test pilot. He flew the aircraft out of the water, and we then had to get out of this mess. I could see on the surface of the water two rafts, which were the mooring rafts for the barrage, two of the barrage balloons. So I conned my pilot between those two, and then we got out. And once we were outside of the ring of the barrage balloons, all the firing at us died down. It was absolutely quiet, straight away, from instead of being the centre of attention on everything, everything was absolutely almost deathly quiet. And there was still a lot of firing going on, but not at us. And I gave my pilot a course for the entrance to the harbour, right low down, skimming over the water. What we didn't know, which we should have known, but it wasn't shown because the photographs didn't go that far, was that at the harbour entrance there were boom vessels controlling the entrance. We should have realised this. But we got to the entrance of the harbour and then we suddenly found the warships right in the entrance where we were flying. So up over their masts again and down the other side as they just about exploded under us. And we then got away out to sea with those ships, all the forts along the breakwater, and the gun positions along the breakwater, etc., all following us out to sea with a mass of fire. Long flog back to the ship. The ship, by then, she was off Corfu and was steaming away to get away from the Italian Air Force, which would almost certainly be out after her very first light. And so we had a chase after her. I actually made for Corfu, took a new departure from Corfu, which only had another 3 or 4 minutes to flying time, and then made out to the ship. And back on board, I can't remember for how long, after about 4.5 hours flying, I suppose it was. We didn't know what we'd done. When you're firing torpedoes at night, unless you're watching at the particular time that the torpedo crosses the target and there's a flash, you don't know whether you hit or not. It looked as though we had done a good shot. I don't think we were credited with one, actually, by the analysis. I'm not certain. Maybe we were too close, because, of course, there was a safety range on these torpedoes, and maybe it hadn't run off completely by the time it hit. When you get back on board after a raid like that, you're terribly taut until you arrive there, and you're terribly anxious as the observer, as the navigator, until you get back. We had no radar in our craft in those days. In general speaking, the ship would not speak to the aircraft because it would give an enemy an indication where the ship was. They then get direction finding on the ship and fix her, so that the enemy would know where to go to try and attack her. There was an elementary beacon which wasn't in use, because again, it was considered to be such an elementary beacon that it would act more, that it would act more as a homing beacon for the enemy than an aid for us to get back to the ship. So really, we were still back in the days of dead reckoning navigation. Anyhow, back on board the ship, there's always anxiety of getting back on board a ship, especially at night, because it's a small spot in the ocean, and if you don't get it, and you don't succeed in finding it fairly soon in a square search wherever you're going around it, you will then go in the water and get drowned. That's the skill of the observer, of course, to get you back on the spot where the ship says she's going to be, or where you know that she's going along a certain track, and you have to get back to that particular point you calculate. We had natural fact done, as you know, a very considerable amount. On the way in to the attack, as I said, we had no advantage of surprise at all anyway. We could see the whole of the assault of the first squadron going on. There was a great cone of fire over Taranto searchlights and the anti-aircraft fire over Taranto as we went in. It died down slightly as we developed the second attack. But in actual fact, ours was particularly difficult because of the various incidents on board of lots of aircraft and so on, and because in actual fact two aircraft of our flight had to go back. Bobby Going and a track called Sam Morford both had to fall out. We didn't have any bombing support at all, so we actually attacked just plain straightforward, bare, raw, with a torpedo aircraft, no diversionary bombing, but we did have the flare droppers and the light of the moon. Things never go as they're planned, and that was it. Anyhow, it was successful, very successful. Subsequently, I had a number of jobs where I came across Italians. Was one when I was in Greece, in Athens, before the Germans took it, and I arranged that I was with the Air Force staff, and I arranged that any episodes where a chap was engaged in sea operations, I was sitting on the interrogation of a captured prisoner. And in one particular case, there was a great big northern Italian, all these fine chaps, his shoulders that broad, and the bomber pilot had been brought down. And the interrogator, who was an RAF squadron leader who spoke Italian, was translating for me the replies and things, and then he rapidly spoke Italian. The Italian got up and came across and kissed me on both cheeks. And I said, "What the hell's happening?" He said, "I just told him you were at Taranto and he wants to congratulate you." And this is typical of the Italians. Italians are very generous, this sort of thing. Much later, I was in 1957 or so, I was in